Today, we're going to talk about how to be effective in our communication and how to just be overall effective when it comes to talking with others, having political type conversations, and engaging as a kingdom person in issues, topics, and just politics in general. We got special guests today. Kyle Spears is going to join us on the All Things to All People podcast. Let's get to it. Welcome back to the All Things to All People podcast with Michael Burns. I am Michael Burns, and we are continuing to go through the topics of politics, allegiance, and kingdom, using as a springboard my book, Escaping the Beast. And today is a special day in the sense of we are arriving at the end of a somewhat long journey. And so this whole second season of the All Things to All People podcast, we've been talking about escaping the beast, politics, allegiance, kingdom. What does our engagement look like? And today we reach the end of that journey for now. And we're going to look at specifically some of the topics from chapter 26, Coddling and Critique is the title of the chapter. And we're going to talk about communication and effectiveness. And so I'm excited to have as our guest today a biblical teacher and friend of mine, Kyle Spears. So Kyle, welcome back, I should say, to the All Things to All People podcast.
Good to be back, my brother.
Yeah, it was last season, not quite a year ago, but it's been a while, maybe like 9 months or something since we've had you on. I think you were on 3 episodes in a row, if my memory serves, which I could be wrong, but I think you might be the only guest to appear in 3 consecutive episodes.
Let's go.
Yeah. So you have that record. You know, overall guest appearances, Jason Alexander is kind of the top dog there, but I think you might be second right now. So
all right, I'll take second.
Yeah, man. No, it's great to have you. Let me give a little bio information for our audience, just to refresh their memory of how cool and impressive of a guy you are. But don't shake your head. It's all true. But you and your wife, Christy, you have a 20-month-old. Tell us about that real quick.
Shay is, his name is Shay Christopher. He's got my name, my dad's name, and my grandfather's name in it, in him. And he is amazing. He's getting tall. I mean, I'm obviously a pretty big guy, but he is.
Yeah, you're 6'10", right? For the audience. Yeah, yeah.
He's off the charts. When we take him to the pediatrician, he is off the charts. And lately, he's been off the chain. He's starting to get those powerful emotions, as you can imagine, and we're trying to help him with those. But man, he has got his hand. We got to get him his first haircut coming.
Nice.
So yeah, he's got long curls. It's time to get this boy's hair cut. So,
yeah.
Go to the barbershop and get it done soon.
I hope that goes well, man. Sometimes it goes well. Sometimes little dudes are like, nope, not for me. So. Yeah. So good luck with that. But man, you've been a disciple for disciple of Jesus. I don't know why I felt the need to say of Jesus, as though the audience might think you were a disciple like of something else, a gangster disciple a disciple of Jesus for about 20 years in both Kansas City and now you're in Omaha, Nebraska. You did your undergraduate at UMKC. And I believe that's University of Missouri, Kansas City. Did I get that right? Yes. Sure. And, oh, man, the you just told me what it was. The Kangaroos.
Yes, the Roos.
The Roos.
But we shortened it to the Roos.
The Roos. Played basketball there, which is awesome. And but, man, you've done your master's degree studies at Rocky Mountain School of Ministry and Harding School of Theology. Do I have that right?
So I did my first master's, which is marriage and family therapy. I did that at Friends University.
Friends University.
Yep, back in 07 and through 09. And then I later went to Rocky Mountain and then and at Harding now in the MDiv program.
Nice. That's fantastic. And you are currently, your role is a marriage and family therapist at the Attachment and Trauma Center of Nebraska.
Yeah.
And I would say ministry-wise, in the role of biblical teacher, you specialize, correct me if this is wrong, but you kind of specialize in trauma theology.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
You want to take a minute and just remind everybody, what is trauma theology?
Yeah, so trauma theology, one of the things I think is really cool is this intersect between trauma and theology. Right now, when you look at psychology and when you look at like psychology and theology, there's pretty good depth there. But the new frontier that we see more and more is trauma, not just psychology, but the subset of trauma. And trauma is sort of pervading everywhere. I mean, when you look at the research that's happening, when you look at when people are in work culture, when it comes to churches, everyone's starting to really grapple with the reality of trauma, even when it comes to biblical justice, when it comes to racism, trauma. You hear trauma everywhere. And I think the opportunity is to understand trauma biblically. And I think to some degree, I mean, you know, for me, one of the things I want to create is just a therapeutic theology. I think it's easy to just have a theology, but we want it to be therapeutically informed. Mm. And that's part of what my passion is in terms of my thesis moving forward and so forth. So got a YouTube channel, podcast and so forth where I'm exploring that. And it's been a ride, especially with COVID, man. So,
yeah. Well, at the end, we'll get your YouTube channel and podcast. I'll have you give it to our audience and we'll put it in the show notes as well so that people can check it out. It's not only quality stuff, content wise, you are a skilled videographer. And so these videos are, man, professionally done. People would think you have like a team in your house there, but you've done the lighting, you've got it all set, man, which is really good. It's really a professional look to it and very well done, which makes it that much easier to watch. So in addition to the great content, so we'll definitely get that out for you at the end and in the show notes. But so Kyle, I had you on today, and I wanted you to give a quick rundown of trauma theology and what you do and are so good at. But that's not what we're going to focus on today. I wanted to have you on and talk about communicating effectively and some of these things as we kind of wrap up. This is actually the last episode in our second season on political engagement as the kingdom of God. And so the way I ended the book, Escaping the Beast, of course, was, you know, to kind of bring together some issues of communication and effectiveness. And you have a real expertise in those areas and have thought some of that through as well. And so I wanted to have you on and talk to us about that. And let me start out with this question. What are some of the biggest errors that we make when it comes to effective communication, when we want to talk about a controversial or a thorny issue? What are some of the mistakes we make up front?
That's a really good question. I think the thing that I've been especially putting content on is this idea of what is our goal? You know, I think when I'm listening to people, I honestly go into it knowing that I'm not going to change their mind. But that's really not the goal. The goal is really to connect their dots, not mine. When we listen to people, it's very difficult because really until our ears are trained, we listen, but we won't hear.
Mm.
And so it's like you listen to someone for 45 minutes and you're like, you know, they tell you, I feel like you don't get it. And your head explodes because you're, what do you mean I don't get it? Listening to you for 45 minutes.
Right.
But if your ears aren't trained, you won't hear it. And so I think for me, one of the biggest issues is that when we're talking to people, we are not helping them to understand that we get them or feel like we get them. Like when you're talking to your best friend. And so I think for me, it's kind of this idea, and I can go into it more, but interrogation versus invitation. We don't even realize when we're doing interrogation, and we don't even know how to do invitation. And that's, I can get more into that here in just a moment, but that's, I think, our biggest issue is we make people feel cornered or even like backed into a corner.
Yeah, I'm fascinated. I want to hear more about interrogation and invitation. Roll that out for us a little bit.
Yeah. So when I'm talking to someone, Proverbs 20 verse 5 is probably one of my favorite scriptures. And the Hebrew there in Proverbs is really this idea of, you know, drawing someone out. It's kind of like you have a bucket. And, you know, this, it's not just that you're going to get the water. You have to know how to get the water. There's something that you use. And when I think of an invitation, I think of something that lowers someone's defenses versus raises them. Interrogation is when we start facting people, or we start kind of, people can fill the agenda. You have to de-agenda the conversation. And so someone, you know, their arousal and so forth can make you just kind of feel a little bit more less guarded. And so when I use an invitation, I use a couple of very key statements. What do you feel like I don't get? What do you feel like I don't understand? And what that does is signal that I'm an ally versus an adversary, right? I want this person to feel like I get them. And I want to get them. So what do you feel like I don't get? Or what do you feel like people misjudge about you? Very key when you're talking to someone, especially when there's a lot of emotional material. The next part is, and there's just a couple here, is what's the most unfair part? Typically, anger is related to injustice, right? So anger gets boundaries up, guilt takes them down. And so when someone has unfairness, typically that's where you'll find a lot of the energy. When I'm talking to someone, I want to be efficient. And so what's the most unfair part about when I cut you off? What's the most unfair part about the systemic aspect of racism? Okay. So the unfairness, typically you're going to find someone's energy, like get really going, but that's okay, because you kind of found out what it is that's activating them. So what's the most unfair part? Thirdly is, what's the biggest threat? This is key, right? When people talk, they really don't know how to get to the core threat, right? And as a result, we end up talking in circles. We do content instead of process. When you ask somebody, what's the biggest threat, you end up finding out what it is that's really at what's really activating them. And so then what you've also done is you've distinguished yourself from that threat. And so threat is also associated with this part of the brainstem that gets going. And our brain, when it gets in that mode, it doesn't identify a physical versus an emotional threat at all. That's why someone can have a crime of passion. You know, when your brain is in that place, it makes the person a thing.
Mm.
And so what's the biggest threat? What scares you the most? And then lastly is, what's the most disappointing part? And, you know, you got to get to the disappointment. You got to get to the fear. You got to get to the unfairness. You got to get to the point where people feel like they are not understood. And if you can do that, people will feel like you are an ally, really, versus an adversary.
That's good stuff. That's helpful. And what that makes me think of, or reminds me of, is I think in very practical, broken down sense, It leads me back to like the concept of Philippians chapter 2, where it sounds like what you're talking about is really going into a conversation for the benefit of the other person with a great deal of humility and even restraint. Because a lot of times we go into a conversation, especially one that is going to involve a conflict, and I want to convince you that I'm right. That's my goal, right? Is I'm coming in to show you where you're wrong and to convince you that I'm right and turn you around so that you can see the truth. But it's really all about me then, in that sense. And so what I hear you saying a lot is, rather than trying to convince, is instead maybe I would sum it up with the word curiosity. and a restrained curiosity to really learn about you and what, where you're coming from. Am I capturing that correctly?
Yeah, I think your phraseology with the curiosity part is so good. I use that a lot, that the cure for criticism is curiosity. And so I'm really glad you brought that up. That curiosity is so necessary. And really, that's part of that in Proverbs 20, verse 5. I think the relational ethic there is that you're empty enough for new information, and people feel honored. People feel that there's a sense of dignity when you're curious about them. And I love that idea of curiosity. I think you're spot on with that, Mike.
No, that's, that's helpful. And of course, that makes me, or makes perhaps other listeners think of the negative phrase, curiosity killed the cat. And you know, it's interesting that that's actually not the original saying or idiom. You know, it used to be care killed the cat is the way the original saying went. And it meant care as in worry. Worrying killed the cat. And somewhere over time, that got led into or changed into curiosity. And so it almost gives a negative connotation to curiosity. But in this case, curiosity is good and helpful.
Now, how do you know that? Like, I'm sitting here like, that is amazing. I'm like, I would have never, did you read that like in a Time magazine? That's so
funny. Yeah. So, well, answer number one is I probably read entirely too much. I have a life. I balance it out, but I do like to read. More so than like, here's the thing. I'm so weird. I think I'm weird in this, and you can confirm this or maybe you'll be like, no, you're not weird at all. Is I think most people, like, say you're scrolling down on social media or something and you see like, oh, this coach said something about this player or some sort of highlight that captures your attention and you click on it. If I click on it and it's a video, I'll click right back out. Because I want to read an article quick. I'm not interested in the video. I feel like most people would rather see the video, but I don't. I want to read it because I can read it quickly. I can skim where I want to skim. I'm not going to sit there for 6 minutes and watch a video, but I'll read an article. So
that makes sense.
Yeah. So I do like to read a lot. And you know, as a history teacher, I used to have all these books about where things came from. You know, where phrases came from. And so for whatever reason, they just stick in my brain, at least some of them. You know, I'll give you another one that's completely unrelated to what we're talking about here, but it just popped into my mind is on ships back in the day, they used to have a room oftentimes underneath the big cannons on a ship. And that room would be a place where perhaps a sailor might bring in a young lady or a prostitute or something. And it was kind of an open room. And so if then that young lady came back later to the ship's captain or whatever and said, hey, one of your sailors got me pregnant, they would literally list it as, because it was this room under the guns, they would list it as son of a gun. And because they couldn't always figure out what sailor it was or whatever. And so they would call them the son of a gun. So that's where the phrase son of a gun came from.
Wow.
So, right. It's weird. I know.
That's good. I would have never thought.
People are like, that added nothing to my life. But there you go. But let me back up here. And I brought up social media a minute ago. A lot of our communication these days, especially during the pandemic, of the last year plus, has been on social media. And that seems to have a whole new sort of world of its own, mind of its own. It becomes a whole new beast, however we want to say it. What are some of the inherent dangers when it comes to communicating through social media or electronically or things like that?
This is an interesting one. I mean, when you look at the psychology of an internet troll, like one day I just looked that up. I'm like, okay, I want to get how, I think it was when I first really started putting videos up and stuff, I'd get people who would just say things, you know, publicly, you know, they would blast you, but privately in the DMs, they would ghost you. I'm like, what's up with that? Like, I guess that was just about the flex, right? Yeah, some people are just about the flex, but I'm like, what's the psychology of an internet troll? And, you know, it's interesting. They've done some research on it, and essentially the distance, the degrees of separation between real human interaction is really the problem. That's, you know, when you look at antisocial, so, you know, just real dark, the dark side of, you know, being antisocial and, you know, pathologically antisocial, the darkest side of that is that there's a real miss between, you know, your humanity gets really stripped from a person. And I think the dehumanization is it's probably my biggest concern. I mean, when I think of like the future research I want to do, it's about, you know, biblical humanity, and that people don't have a way to understand what it means to be a human being really biblically. And I think so when you look at, like, if you go online, you'll find someone, they'll post something. Typically you'll find the trolls in the subthreads. They won't even be out like where it's visible. They'll be down in the subthreads, and that's where they cause the commotion. They'll say something crazy. And I think where some people are, this is kind of an interesting thing. Like, I think you have trolls who just want to create commotion. And I think you have trolls who actually want to create a conversation. They just want to make you think. And I think to some degree, like, you have both. And, you know, you got keyboard courage. That's one for the cliche community, right? Where, like, when it comes to the computer or your phone, like, I even looked it up on, I think it's Urban Dictionary, I think it is. But this idea of, like, when it comes to real life, you never say that. Kind of like when you're in your car, you have that, like, bubble. But when it comes to, you know, if you have some distance, you can say crazy stuff. And so the thing that they really talk about is just, like, false bravery. Like, truth is like, people aren't really that brave.
Yeah.
Because when it comes down to it, people have long-standing resentment and feuds. And then it's like, well, how is it then that we're so brave, but we're so cowardly when it comes to real conflict? And that's that, like, conflict resolution next to, like, life coaching and executive coaching is like the next field. People are getting their master's degrees in conflict resolution, because part of what this is creating is people don't actually have the skills for reconciliation. They don't actually have the skills to talk to one another. So anyway, I could go on and on about that, but
no, that's good. And, you know, it almost reminds me, and I don't know if this is way out there, but I think of, you know, people who have an issue with spending money, for instance. Sometimes they'll get a credit card and they'll just spend, or they can click, 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 click. And so one of the remedies of that is, you know, use cash, because when you have that cash in your hand and you see the money going out and you see it dwindling, you're less likely to, you know, it's that tangible element where you're less likely to just spend as you can be online or with a credit card. And so it almost seems like a little bit of that is going on with some of the social media communication, is there's not that tangible, you know, eye to eye communication. I see the ramifications of what I just said. Because, you know, you can have these conversations in your head. I don't know if you do that where it, you know, in my head, I am the most brilliant communicator of all time, right? And everything, have you ever done that where you're like, I've got this all planned out, what I'm going to say. And then you start saying it and you're like, wait a minute, this is muddled. This was so good and perfect in my head. Why is it not coming out the same way? If you know, and it's different. And so I think, you know, people can sometimes unleash that voice on the keyboard that, you know, is much harsher, doesn't consider the other person, you know, because I know when you're face to face with someone, you can start saying some things and then you see the looks on their face, or you realize the ramifications and you, oh man, you know what? this was not as easy to accuse them of this and this and this.
Right.
You know, when I was alone, it made all sense. You know, they're the most evil person in the world. And now face to face, it's like, it just, it changes reality almost, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think of that, and I think of, you know, I've seen a couple memes, and I don't advocate violence, but there is a little bit of humor to this where I've seen people say, you know, the problem with people nowadays is they've gotten way too comfortable at disrespecting people without getting punched in the face for it. You know, because there's just that face to face reality. And maybe the other element of that is you don't need to share your opinions on every little thing and, you know, everything. You know, like keep it to yourself. You know, is a big one. And of course, you know, filter, I talk in the book about filtering it through as a disciple and, you know, those sorts of things, bringing glory to God rather than ourself. But, now that's good. Let me ask you a little bit of a turn here, but still in the same ballpark. Is part of the communication challenge these days is, you have, you know, one portion of the population that's very much about political correctness. You got to say things respectfully, the right way, you know, the right words, don't use those words. And it can kind of change in the standards a bit for some people and they get confused. And then you have on the other side, people complaining, well, that's turned into cancel culture. And so now we have this element of cancel culture. You say anything wrong and they will come after you. Especially online, the people that really seem intentionally bent on you aired, and now we're gonna tear your life down. And of course, from there, you know, from the positive aspect of that, people would say, "No, that's just reaping the consequences for your own words or actions or behavior." And so now we have this further divide over political correctness and cancel culture and all of that. So it's all confusing. It's very divisive. So straighten this all out for us, Kyle. Make it simple. Solve this in 2 to 3 minutes. How can a Christian view political correctness and cancel culture, and what can we do to navigate those waters?
Yeah, bro. This is, man, this problem is God-sized. you know, it's interesting. I have a couple thoughts on it. Unlike your head, so your head, everything is like all smooth and everything. My head is loud, and there's tons of voices and chaos, and there's this huge squall going on. So we're different there. I have a lot of thoughts. So I think that, you know, for a lot of people, they make statements. But my question is, there a conversation that you want to have? People, when they have big feelings, they typically have low skills. And you got really big feelings around this thing, but then we actually don't have skills for the conversation. And so people drop these bombs. You know, in therapy, we call them like the skeleton. Like the last 5 minutes, someone gives you skeletons in their closet, and then they leave. And it's like, well, we don't actually have to have any courage for relationship now because I've got to go. And I feel like that's a lot of where people are. I'll give you a great example. I can't give you the specific of our squad results, but the first thing we did in our church is we did a survey of our church. And we got like 100 members, 90 members. We had 70 people fill out this survey. Oh, wow. It was like a flashlight. We were able to see where our congregation really is. And this, you know, so we had different priorities. The one thing I can say is we prioritized by politics, by racial issues, and when we by COVID. So those were our three categories. And we were able to see what was most important to each. And we opened it up for comments. And the comments that people shared, wow. And basically, you kind of give this dichotomy of politics, you know, being politically correct versus cancel culture. That was there was a lot of substance for people around those things. And people just feel, basically, I think to some degree, people feel silenced. that's part of where you find that intense reversal for people. They feel, and the reality is, people are having conversations with or without you. You can be sure of that. But people, to some degree, there's that, like, I can't say anything because I'm going to be a racist or I'm going to be an anti-vaxxer or whatever. But at the same time, people are deeply resentful about just now all of a sudden getting canceled. And I think, let me give a therapeutic response to this very briefly. John Gottman, incredible marriage and family therapist, does incredible research. He has these bids of connection. You have turn towards, turn against, and turn away. So when someone tells you something, you can turn towards it, which is where you were talking about curiosity and so forth. You can turn towards it. You can turn away from it, where you now avoid what it is, whatever that energy is, whatever the person is, you avoid this person, or you turn against, which is you now aggressively engage, or you now intensively engage. I think to some degree, people don't know how to bid. Going back to our last question, I think part of it's that we're getting more disconnected. We're more connected, but we're actually more disconnected. People don't know how to bid for connection, and they don't know when someone's bidding with them. And so we have to, especially as disciples, we have to be able to bid with one another successfully. If someone's turning towards me, I need to be aware to not turn against or turn away from them. So again, I think some of our skills around social interaction and so forth, like, they're atrophying. And so I think we have to have better ways of offsetting what we're finding in terms of what's happening.
Mm. That's brilliant. And that actually, in a sense, kind of rolls into another question I want to ask you. And it has to do actually with, I talk about an Escaping the Beast, but I mention another book called The Coddling of the American Mind by Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt. And in there, they talk about this idea. Well, they actually talk about three really bad ideas that they say are currently really harming Western culture. And one of them is what they call anti-fragile. And the way they describe anti-fragile basically is, you know, there are things that are resilient. You know, I have a water bottle next to me that's one of these really heavy-duty, hard plastic, supposed to be unbreakable. You can throw it. You can drive over it. It's resilient. It's not going to break. Then you might have something else. You know, we have china. I had a plate the other day. I dropped it just a few inches out of my hand under the counter, and it just shattered all over the place. And so that's fragile. And they said we tend to think in terms of humans as well being either resilient or fragile, but they make the case that actually humans are something else, that we need that testing, we need that struggle, and that's called anti-fragile. And an example of that would be like a muscle, where for a muscle to get stronger and reach its full potential, you actually have to cause it some trauma. You have to put it through some work, otherwise it will never be what it needs to be. And they say that's the same way with humans. And so they say the first bad idea is that what doesn't kill you makes you weaker. We've become a society that wants to make everything safe, keep us from any harm, any other ideas, any, you know, anything that might make us feel unsafe or make that we don't like or whatever. That might be a little bit of a risk. We've got to sanitize that out of the culture. And they say that's actually working against who we are as anti-fragile. So I want to talk about the other two things they bring up, but let me stop there and get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so it's interesting you bring that up, man. That's a trigger word. So in our efforts to try to be more understanding sociologically, it has completely backfired. And I mean, I'll be honest with you, I feel at times frustrated at what people missed when this conversation entered the scene. So for example, Robin DiAngelo brings this idea of fragility up, and she writes a book after, right?
Right.
99% of what Robin DiAngelo says sociologically is spot on. The problem is it's loaded into a political discussion. people, typically Western dominant culture, will not discuss sociological issues. What they will discuss are politics. That's how they load in sociology. The problem with that is part of sociology is actually about community. We have over-identified with Western concepts of individuality. So now when you put that into the mix, now people can't, you can't talk about people as a group because they think in terms of individual. They enmesh themselves with that concept of individualism. I guess all of that say, if you want to call someone fragile, that would be to me on the other side of calling them a racist. Mm. Because what you're doing is you're using a, and this is where I think we have to find out when we're talking to people a language that works for them. And I mean, if you want to, I don't know, if you want to win the intellectual side, not you, but anyone, if they want to win the intellectual side, that's fine, but you're going to lose the relationship. I mean, I really think we're at a point where we have to figure out different terms for some of these things that we want to discuss. You know, I love the term of what you're talking about, and I agree with it. I just think some people get so triggered with those words.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And we've talked on here about that before, just the idea of I completely lost my thought. How about that? I had a thought and it just went right out of my head. Man, I had it and then I was trying to balance another thought and bring something in and like, okay, I got to ask him that. And then I'm going to circle around to this. And now I've lost both thoughts. So that must mean it's time to move on. Let's bring up the second issue and maybe that thought will come back to me. Second idea they say is that we should always trust our feelings, that we've become a culture that says, you know, trust your feelings. They bring you to your true self. And they bring out the idea that that's actually quite problematic, that that's not biblical, it's not helpful. What is your reaction to that?
Absolutely. Feelings are great friends. They're not great leaders. And here's the other thing. People don't even know the difference, and I'm in this category sometimes, between their feelings and their emotions. You would think, oh, that's the same. Yeah, let's just do dangerous simplicity. No, the reality is you actually have to be in your body to understand what you feel. And I think to some degree, a feeling is the one that you're having right now. The thing that you're most aware of is a feeling. Emotions and something are something we're in all the time. That's why when people say they're not emotional, that's completely false. In order to be connected to your emotions, you have to be sort of integrated and you have to be able to feel them typically in your body. And so where people are being led as far as their feelings and their emotions and then that being your truth is most people don't have good, they don't have good advisors around them. You know, feelings are, I think, and I work with feelings for a living, emotions for a living, they're a great starting place. In no way are they the destination. They're a part of the process. And they help you to understand where you're at in terms of your experience. But no, feelings, you know, they will lead you to some very dark places.
Yeah.
Anyway, I mean, that's something we all, yeah.
No, yeah. And so I remembered my previous thought.
Yeah.
Let me circle back to that. As I was going to say, we've talked a lot on the podcast about the difference of, you know, individual mindset versus collective cultures and how that leads us into different concepts. And I thought about that as you were saying that. There's a book that I think illustrates that perfectly. I have it over there on my shelf. It's written by Love Seacrest and a number of other authors. He's the editor, but it's called, I'll read you the title and then I'll explain why I think of this. The title is called Can White People Be Saved? Triangulating Race, Theology, and Mission. And now, so here's the thing. If you read that from a individual political lens, you're going to be super offended. Like, what kind of book title is that? Can White People Be Saved? He's talking about me. I'm a white people, you know? And, but if you switch the lens and realize that he's talking sociologically, missiologically, and collectively, he's not talking, you know, they'll say, yes, of course, a white person can be saved, but can a group of people with the, that have been inundated and sort of indoctrinated into the worldview and reality of white normativity, can they continue to live out that white normativeness and truly be kingdom people? And he says, of course, no, there's a fundamental, you know, disparity between those two. But he's speaking sociologically and collectively, not saying, oh, someone can't be saved or, you know, they're lesser because they're a white person. And so I think it just illustrates that perfectly, that if you come at it from a individual lens, you're going to get a very different feeling of what that title is actually communicating.
I appreciate that. Let me say one thing on that. I'm really glad you brought that up.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that I'm gonna pump you up here for a little bit. One of the things that I really appreciate about what you do is you give a biblical reference point for this issue. So, for example, one of the things that I think that, especially in the church, why Robin DiAngelo got pushed so hard against is because she's coming at things from a, although it's sociological, still from a philosophical position, an ideological position. That's not going to long-term sustain the conversation in the church. Where you come from, I think, is a position that long-term is much more sustainable. Also, you know, David Swanson in his book, Rediscipling the White Church, his idea, again, as you well know, is we don't have a diversity problem. We have a discipleship problem.
Right.
Again, discipleship is about relationship. Relationship is a contact sport. So I just want to say, I want to give you some props again. Your approach to this issue is what's sustainable long-term, I think, in terms of kingdom and culture. And that, you know, you and David Swanson, I think, have a little bit of overlap. But I think I would really suggest and really hope that people don't continue to try to import too much philosophy into this issue, especially when it comes to the kingdom.
Yeah. Okay. No, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. Let me jump over to the third bad idea, according to Lukianoff and Haight. And they say that life is a battle. This is the third bad idea, that life is a battle between good people and evil people. And that if someone offends you or thinks differently than you do, then you paint them in this biochromatic world of good and evil. You're either with me or you're against me. You're smart or you're an idiot. You get it or you don't. And they say that's a really difficult way to move forward in the world, is this sort of binary world of good and evil. So what do you think about that?
Recently at the racial justice conference we just had, I talked about this idea that trauma doesn't allow two things to be true at the same time. Trauma gets you to live in one part of your brain versus the other.
Mm.
So you can think but not feel, or feel but not think. What trauma also does is it overdevelops. Right. So when I hear someone and they're stuck in one part of their brain, that to me, that's an adaptation. That's someone who has had a series of experiences that have not allowed them to be really kind of they're not integrated. And so there's a lack of discipleship. And I the both and, Mike, I kid you not, in my life and everyone's life, the both and requires more energy than anything else in this universe. To hold two things as true requires more bandwidth, more discipline, more grace, more mercy, more perspective than anything. To hold both things as true at the same time, especially when it's painful. And the more painful it is, the more difficult it is to hold both things as true.
Hmm.
And so for people, I mean, at the end of the day, we don't just, so this weekend, I'm talking at the conference, you are too. I'm going to be talking about the reenactment, right? People get focused on how the reaction. No. There's a reenactment that's happening. When I make assumptions and you make assumptions, we're not just reacting, we're reenacting something that we haven't been curious enough about, and we don't know how to have the conversation about. And so when we do this binary aspect, that's a reenactment. And in our church, I think that, again, when we have big feelings and low skills, you're now going to start to see that sociologically play out. And now it's not just about theology. I think it was last semester in school, they talked about how a lot of our theology is actually sociological in nature. But anyway, it's a reenactment, and we don't know how to be curious enough about it. And it's concerning.
Yeah, no, that's really helpful. And just for clarity's sake for the audience, as we are filming this, or recording this rather, the conference is coming up this weekend, but by the time the audience hears this, the conference will have happened. So don't scramble around online looking for what is this conference Kyle is speaking of. You're referring to the Let Justice Roll conference put on by the Teleos Society. Will have already happened by the time that the audience hears this podcast.
What are you speaking on, bro? In the conference?
Oh, I don't know. We'll make it up as we go.
Whatever, dude.
I try to be me at things like this, and I know it's a bit of an academic conference, but I'm not an academic, and so I'm gonna talk about the role of culture in. And how that can be an obstacle to conversations on justice and even moving forward in justice. You know, as we talk about ideas of justice, and again, it's that idea of the individualist cultured person or enculturated person is going to view what justice is and how to best bring it about very differently than a collectivist enculturated person would. And so they're not even going to be able to have productive conversations if we don't understand a few things about culture first. So that's the thrust of it.
Be hot, brother.
Well, the whole conference is great. So if you're listening to this now, go online and you can probably find the classes from that conference and check it out. But let me before we go here, Kyle, I want to sneak in one more question. What are some of the best ways that Christians can act? So we're in an age of fake news, false reporting, biased media, conspiracy theories, and I want to ask you, what are some basic principles or concepts that we can use to help us in those areas as Christians, so that we're not just sort of tossed back to and fro by every wind of reporting or fake news that we see?
Yeah, I get pretty passionate about, because this is a real problem. Like lies matter. And when you see Paul handle this in the epistles, I mean, Paul's theology, a lot of it is about culture, but it's also about philosophy. He, for instance, you take Colossians, he's writing about this philosophy. We don't know exactly what it was. It's probably a mix between Phrygian folklore, Jewish mysticism of the region. And it's like angel worship. And then you got, these different days and diets, and you got this syncretist type of thing where we're merging all these things. And so it's like, okay, well who's your broker? Like, where's your source? Paul is constantly trying to get people in the epistles who's your source? Okay, where'd you get that from? Because last time I checked, Christ is the mediator. He's the broker. He's how we know what the Father's will is. He is the Father's exegete. So in terms of really addressing this, I really encourage people to read the epistles. It's this Jesus plus. So when I think of, Paul's big issues with, these philosophies and these people that have these different, sub-religions. And they don't have a problem with Jesus. They kind of do, but they just add and add and add and add and add anything that's Jesus plus. And so I just always want to know for people. Like, so for example, I was watching this documentary on Hulu on QAnon, and they actually have several. They've got Vice. Vice is, I thought they just did magazine stuff, but Vice does different documentaries. QAnon, BLM, some of the other critical players in the game too. And I was just sitting there like, wow, I didn't know that about QAnon. And QAnon, in many ways, as far as the Forgotten Tribe is the white middle class, they have really set some roots down in the overall groupthink. It's interesting, as much as we don't want to think like a group and we want to do individual, we really are influenced collectively. But QAnon is responsible for so much, because part of what the political heads have done is they've utilized the sort of the plumbing that QAnon has put forth. So, and I get that most people wouldn't necessarily know what QAnon is and so forth. But again, I think to some degree, people, there's nothing new under the sun, Mike. You know this. Paul dealt with many of the things that we're dealing with now in his epistles when he wrote. I really encourage people to use their Bible. And the Bible isn't just meant to be read, it's meant to be understood.
Yeah.
People would be willing to do that. So.
Yeah, no, that's spot on. And I think too, you know, people have a tendency to believe what we want to be true. And so, you know, if we hear something and it's like, yeah, I want that to be true, we're going to be more convinced by it and quicker to pass it on. So I encourage disciples as well. Absolutely. Start with the biblical worldview, but then on a practical level, just, you know, don't share that until you've really like kind of fact checked it out. But you know, yes. Like really, yeah. You know, I mean, look it up, do some work, you know, multiple reputable sources, that sort of thing. It is that, because there's so many times where people will share something. I'm like, man, in 8 seconds, I can go and Google that and find out that that's not true, that just didn't take place. And so I encourage fact checking, and you know, if you get down that rabbit hole of like, well, the fact checkers are all biased and can't be trusted too. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, then use a bunch of them or whatever, but that's really a not healthy place to be when you can't trust any expert on anything. And I actually read a book recently. And it's called, I don't know if you've heard of this book, it's called A Lot of People Are Saying, The New Conspiracism and the Assault on Democracy. And what they talk about there is they said there's a classical conspiracy thinking or theory. And that was based on alternate, you know, sort of a different set of facts. Like you've researched things and said, oh, look, let me give a different interpretation or a different, here are facts you didn't know about. And there's this conspiracy going on. And it might not be true, but it was presenting a different worldview of facts. But they say now there is this new conspiracy that's taking hold that it doesn't even have that as a foundation anymore. It doesn't need facts or truth. What it rests on is the fact that a lot of people are saying it, that a lot of people believe it. Well, look how many people believe in QAnon, for example. So that then gives it a credibility in this mind. And so the author goes into how that's very deconstructionist, and you know it makes it very difficult because then you can't counter it with facts. And so I would encourage Christians, before you believe something, make sure that there's facts behind it, that you've studied it out, that it's not just one source. I always read both sides on things like that to get sort of a balanced view. And let's be a light in this area rather than part of the problem. All that said, I'm going to ask you this question, thinking of more of the older style, the classic conspiracy theory. What's your favorite conspiracy theory? Do you have a favorite one?
My first would be JFK, just because we had a class in high school that really deconstructed it. But I would actually say the one that I hit the most, man, there's a couple. Creature from Jekyll Island. I mean, 9/11.
Oh, yeah.
I would say 9/11, just because I started getting into some of the science of what happened. Dude, I have been in a conspiracy. Like, so this is going to sound really contradictory, Mike. At the same time, the more I got into my Bible, the less I got into conspiracy. But like, I was pretty into 9/11 being an inside job. I know that sounds really sacrilege. My wife was in the Air Force, and I brought it up to her, and dude, that burned the barn down. but like 9/11 being an inside job with building 7, especially what happened with that. But yeah, just, but then I've just kind of gotten off. I say 9/11.
Well, now see, no, I'm with you. And now see, you answered that seriously. Like the ones that, you know, you sort of, you know, in the past have been like, oh, maybe, you know, and wrestled with. The only issue of that I actually like, okay, maybe that could happen. We've talked about it on the podcast a couple of times, so we're not going to get into it, but Sasquatch, it's theoretical. For me, when I say like my favorite ones, see, I'm kind of obsessed with conspiracy theories. I find them vastly entertaining. And so I don't believe in them. Part of, you know, the recent years where conspiracies become such a big thing, it's kind of taken some of the fun out of it for me because I enjoyed being entertained by some of these conspiracy theories. And now they've done like, you know, there's been some that have done some real damage in real time in the world. But my top three favorite conspiracy theories, and again, to clarify, not ones that I believe in, but just ones I enjoy reading about and watching documentaries on and kind of debunking in a sense. Number three would be the Illuminati.
That's a good one, bro.
Number two is the ancient alien theory. Okay. I have watched pretty much every episode of History Channel's Ancient Aliens. I even have a t-shirt with Giorgio Tsoukalos on it. If you don't know who that is, you're just going to have to look it up. He's the guy, there's the ancient alien meme, you know, where he says, I'm not saying it was aliens, but it was aliens. So ancient aliens. And then number one, my all-time favorite to study and debunk is Flat Earth.
Oh, man, you actually have some good ones, bro. here's my question. You have to admit, and when all of this happens, there comes a point where you know that little crisis point in your head, ding, 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 the light goes off, like, what if? With all of these, have you had that moment where it's like, well, maybe. Like, for a moment, you were 50-50, or were you always just sure? No, that's...
Well, you know, maybe the one when I was younger was like, okay, maybe there is an Illuminati. I could buy into that, you know, had that moment. With ancient aliens, not so much, because being a historian by trade, I kind of knew some of the things that they were saying in the leaps in logic. There, we won't go into it here. There's actually some truth to some of the normal history that they debunk that's actually right, but they just then misinterpret it and think that everything has to be aliens to explain it. I think there's other better, more historical and fact-driven explanations. And then Flat Earth never appealed to me, you know, because, for instance, one of the things is there's certain flights that would be really, really a much different time if the Earth was flat. And I've taken some of those flights. And so, you know, and they'll go on and say, oh, there's not really a flight from South Africa to, you know, Argentina. You can't do it. It's a false flag. And I've known people literally, like, I've taken that flight 5 times, you know, like, yes, it's a real flight. So didn't appeal to me in that sense. The one that probably did for quite a while was the JFK one, where I was like, oh yeah. And even now in the back of my mind, there's like, maybe there's a few things there that we still don't know, you know? So, anyways, we'll end there. Kyle, thanks so much for coming on and straightening some of this out and for finishing off the Escaping the Beast and our deep dive into political engagement as citizens of the kingdom. Appreciate having you on, man, and we'll have you on again in the future. Next season on the All Things to All People podcast, we got a few more episodes this season, and then we're going to get into crossing the line and start digging into my book, Crossing the Line, Culture, Race, and Kingdom, and all those sorts of topics. So we'll definitely have you on next season, and I look forward to it, man. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on, bro.
All right. Oh, Kyle, wait. Before you leave, I said that we were going to ask you about your media, your YouTube and podcast. Tell us about that stuff.
Yeah, so I'm going to be launching my website, truetraumatheology.com. And you can email me, kylespears@truetraumatheology.com, if you have specific questions. I got to a point where I just was having a ton of conversations, and people want resources. And one thing I learned is people deserve those. And so the website was just the best venue to actually give people what they're looking for. So on there, I'm going to have my podcast, which will be a little bit more of an expanded conversation than my YouTube videos. My YouTube channel is True Trauma Theology as well. And then I'm going to be doing blogs, which for those that like to read, I think, Mike, you like to read instead. You probably would like my blog more. I'm going to be doing just some short blogs that kind of work as resources as well. So my goal is just to get people what they're looking for when they need it. And it's going to take me a little bit of time to get it all stacked up, but I'm really looking forward to it. So those are some of the resources that I'm going to have available for people.
Perfect. So the YouTube channel is True Trauma Theology, and the website is truetraumatheology.com.
Yep.
All right. There you go. Got that in. I'll have that in the show notes. Thanks, friend.
All right, brother.
Well, there you have it. As always, it was great to have Kyle on. He did an amazing job, as he has every time he's been on the podcast. So it's great to have him and to hear his thoughts on these matters. Thank you so much for joining me on this journey as we've gone through Escaping the Beast. We've got a couple more episodes in this season that aren't directly springing from Escaping the Beast and on politics, but I think we're going to have three kind of standalone episodes here, the three or four here that'll be helpful and encouraging to you. So please check those out. And then next season, we'll be moving into Crossing the Line, Culture, Race, and Kingdom, and starting that soon enough. So thanks for joining me. If you have any feedback or questions, you can write me at allthingsallpeoplepodcast@gmail.com. And as always, you can go to the website, michaelburnsteachingministry.com. If you need any of my books or things of that nature. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time, All Things to All People podcast.